So here we are at Mary Southern's house. It's Richard Mackey with Graham Wynn, Graham Zilm, and it's the 22nd of November, 2012. Mary, I thought we could start
You're starting on the wrong foot. I don't like being called by my Christian name by strangers.
All right.
I don't like that one bit.
What would you prefer?
The Southern will do, although most people still call me Judge, but I don't mind one thing or the other.
Miss Southern, could we start with your early life and your parents' background, perhaps?
Well, my father was an engineer. He was born in Nanaimo in 1895. In the Canadian Army in the First War. Commanded a platoon at Vimy, was wounded, didn't have to go back. After the war, he came out and he'd had to leave school when he was 14, but he started to get an education, and then he met my mother in Squamish in 1919 or 1920. She was the daughter of a tugboat captain on this coast, Arthur Balko, who had come here on the first scheduled train in 1887, gone back to Ontario 2 years later and married his sweetheart, my grandmother. And mother had gone to McGill, graduated in 1914, the only one of the family who did. And she and my father met when she was teaching school. She taught him his physics and math, and he became a professional engineer.
So, but he wasn't her student formally?
No. He was working in the Squamish steam plant. This is all, she was the school teacher. And school teachers in those days always had in small British Columbia towns, a long succession of beaux. Any school teacher who was in a small town of British Columbia was halfway intelligent and attractive, never lacked for male hopefuls.
What did you did you say her last name was?
Balkwill, B-A-L-K-W-I-L-L. That's a Devonshire name.
And they had come from England to Ontario?
Her father had been born in Devon, near Biddeford. And he and his brother and his parents had come out here sometime, I guess, in about the mid-1870s, come out to London, Ontario. And his parents died in an epidemic when he was about 17. And so, with what little money he had, he came out west. It was all go west, young man. I mean, there was no future for him there. He learned to be a tugboat master, and that's what he did. And he was killed in 1920 when the hawser he was tying up with the thing broke for some reason and hit him. So it's all part of the history of British Columbia.
And your dad's family, you said before the interview that they had a farming connection.
Well, my great grandfather, William Ward, was a merchant in Carlisle. Decided that British Columbia looked like a nice place, so he came out here with his wife and his four children, none of whom were then grown up, including my grandmother. My grandmother had got to know a young man, William Southern, when they were in Carlisle, who was in the army. He was a sergeant major in the King's Own Scottish Borderers. And he had joined up, so he had 7 years to do, and after the 7 years were up, he came out here, left the army, and married my grandmother, and they had the farm.
Where was it?
Farm. It was at Shemaeus at Saltier. But they had the farm, and the other kids did other things. You know, I mean, people did what they had to do. And so I spent some of my childhood visiting the farm. Visiting a farm is fun when you're a child. It's not a, but what a way to live, you know.
Did your parents live there at the time?
Oh, no, my parents never lived at the farm.
But you visited cousins?
You go visit your grandparents, don't you?
Grandparents.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm. And is it still in the family?
No, after my grandmother died after the war, about 1951-52, my uncle had it, one of my uncles, but after a few years, he sold it too. His wife wasn't well, and so it's not in the family, which is rather too bad in a way, but who would have done it anyway? I mean, none of us wanted to be farmers. It'd be nice to have had it, I suppose, as a summer place, but in order to do that, you'd have had to tear down the house and rebuild it. Oh, you know how farmhouses were when they were built, say, 1895, somewhere in there. There was no running water upstairs, no indoor plumbing. No, I mean, everybody lived like that, but who wants to live like that nowadays?
So,
nobody. Certainly no woman would want to live like that.
So this was the southern farm.
It was the southern farm, yeah.
And was your grandfather, did he have a profession apart from...
Being a soldier?
As a soldier?
He thought he did. Being sort of a gentleman farmer, so my grandmother had to do most of the work. No, and then the first war came along, and he went back into the army for a while, and, you know, in some ways he was a bit of a... He didn't work as hard as he should have. That's all. I don't want to talk anymore about that. Those are family past things that one doesn't want to talk about.
What about the First World War? You mentioned it, but the centennial is coming up next year, 2 years from now.
Well, my father was in the First War. He had joined when he was 14, he was sent to Montreal to be an apprentice at the Grand Trunk Railway yards. Well, what do poor boys do? Did they do in Montreal in 1912? Things like that. Have any fun? They joined the militia. You know, that's what they did. And they could have no other boys of their age and do things together and have a bit of a holiday in the summer. But of course, nobody was planning on a war. As soon as the war came, they weren't militia anymore. They were soldiers going off to England. He was only 18 or something like that. But that's what happened, the Royal Montreal Regiment.
And you said he was at the Battle of
Vimy. Yeah. Oh, they was in France before that, of course, in the retreat from Mons, and then they went. Then he was sent. He was sick, and he was sent back for a while, and then he went back with the 29th Battalion from here, and they were at Vimy, and that. Too bad, since you're into these things, I don't still have it. I handed it on to one of my nieces as a family, so see that the family souvenirs don't get mislaid when I die. I had his message book. You know, he was, as I say, he was 20, 21, and the message book in the morning after Vimy had a list of his platoon, the ones marked K and the ones marked W, and a couple of the W's had been turned into K's. Pretty sad stuff, isn't it? Just kids. Years younger than you are. Years younger than you are.
What was he wounded or gassed or anything?
He was wounded. No, I don't think there was any gas in him. No, he was wounded. Fortunately, not badly. Crazy.
But it was enough to get off the...
It was enough that he didn't have to go back again. was sent back here to, and there was an army cantonment, you know, at what is now Hastings Park, where they did a lot of training, military training, and that's what he was doing for the last part of the war after he came back. Anyway, that's all the past, you know. You get rid of the past.
What's past history and what's missed mystery is something to...
Well, of course, I suppose people's family history influences the way they think about things. But
did he talk about the war much?
No, very, very rarely.
You can't blame him, I expect. The farm. I just want to have one more question about the farm because we want to talk to Kim Campbell, who was a graduate of the law school as well.
Yes, I know. Yes.
And she has some connection with a farm in on that part of the island.
Oh, does she?
Mm-hmm. Through one side of her family, but as an islander, I have to.
She grew up in Carisdale too, didn't she? Yeah. She's a lot younger than I am, though.
And am I allowed to ask when you were born?
Oh, well, I'm sure you could find out easily enough. 16th of October, 1931.
And by that time, were your parents here in Vancouver?
Yeah, I grew up in a house at the corner of 42nd and Maple, just two blocks from here. My parents moved there in 1927. My father was the municipal engineer for Point Grey by then, when they bought the house. Then, of course, the provincial government forced the amalgamation of Point Grey with the city of Vancouver, and there were no golden handshakes in those days. He was out of a job.
What year was that?
Well, that was 28, I guess, when the amalgamation took place.
So it was just before the Depression?
Just before the Depression. Yes, a very bad time all around. Engineers were not in great demand, but somehow Mother and Dad managed, and we didn't lose the house. But, you know, until engineers got steady jobs again, Dad got a steady job in Princeton at the Granby Consolidated Mining Development there in 1936. And my sister, who's died, but she used to laugh. I had two older sisters. One year the school was going to start and they both wanted some new things, and Mother just said to them, "No, your father needs a new suit. There'll be no new clothes this September." And a man had to have a suit because if he was going to get a job, he couldn't look like a scruffy, that he was too down on his luck, you know. That's not a way to get a job.
So he spent 6 or 8 years doing
various things, always out of town. But then that's what engineers always had to do. There weren't any, I mean, engineering jobs in the city are few and far between in those days. Engineers went out of town, they worked. No, there were still things happening, but they never happened in town.
So what,
it wasn't like that. You just got accustomed to the fact your father wasn't around to do anything. Your mother always had to do everything.
What were some of the places he worked?
Oh, he worked on various, I think there's some mine on Vancouver Island. I mean, because Star was pretty small while that was going on. But then in 1934 or 35, Granby Consolidated decided to reopen the copper mine at Copper Mountain near Princeton.
Just east of Princeton,
it's just east of Princeton. There's a copper area through there, and there was mining there before the 30s, and Granby Consolidated was an American company, and they came up here, and they opened, or maybe it was still open, one of the mines across the small community, Tulamine.
Mm-hmm.
They built put in a conveyor system that brought the coal across the river to a power site near Princeton. The power went from there all the way up to Copper Mountain and to the mill site, which was at Allenby, which was 5 miles from Princeton. So there was a town site at Allenby and there was a town site at Copper Mountain. There was a one-room school at Allenby. I went there for a while.
So it took a... 1935-36 fits with the recovery from the Depression.
For the Depression, yeah. Daddy had a steady job, and my eldest sister was able to go to university. Which she would not have been able to do had he not. After that, we were always quite prosperous. Anyway, we all went to university.
And then so he moved back to Vancouver at some stage.
Well, no, he never did, not to really... After that, we went to Montreal in 1942. He was in the Federal Aircraft. And then we came back here for a while, and he was with one of the other engineering companies. Then my mother went back east again, and after that, he was in Africa and in Pakistan and in Texas and in New Zealand, doing engineering jobs all over the place until he got to retirement age.
What was his specialty?
Well, he was, according to the rules, he was an electrical and mechanical engineer, but what his specialty really was making people get their jobs done, no matter what was being built. He was pretty tough. Mm-hmm. Tough.
You mentioned...
It was nice to us. I don't want to give you the false impression. But I think he was a taskmaster when it came to construction jobs being done right. And, you know...
He had a reputation,
I think, for making the construction jobs work. Something was to be built, it was to be built and built right. And built when it was supposed to be built, on time and all that sort of, on time, on budget. You know, the whole business about engineering.
Before I wanted to ask you about your uncles who worked in the mill in Chimanas. Those your dad's...
They were my father's brothers. They were dad's brothers.
And if...
They were younger. He was the eldest.
Did they have professional qualifications, or they were...
No, neither one of them did.
And is the family's... still there on the island, or have they moved?
Oh, I think there are still some of the family on the island, but I don't see much of them. I have one cousin that, when he turns up with his wife, very nice man, but you know, the years go by and people don't keep up. We have never had a family reunion or anything like that. I guess the last time we were all together was when one of my uncles died, and we all met, you know.
And you mentioned your sisters. They're older than you. And what were their names?
My eldest sister, Adrian, lives in California. She married... Second husband was Thompson Drummond Hay, and... they split up and she stayed on in California with the children. My second sister, Eleanor Henriksen, died in 2005.
And did they all, did you all go to UBC, or were you follow your father east?
No. See, they went to university during the war, and they started in 36, 37 in there, so they'd graduated before we moved east. Nori, Eleanor, the second one, graduated the same year that we went to Montreal, which was 1942.
And so you were born in 1931, and it sounds like you went up with your dad to the Princeton area.
We went there for a while. Part of the time, we were all here because my sisters were at university. They couldn't be left on their own, you know. Not in those days. You didn't leave 18-year-old girls on their own. And you shouldn't do it now, but that's another question. And so, we were here, and he was up there. One year, we did go up for part of the year, 1940. I remember that very well because it was the time of the fall of France. Dad was there. My grandfather, who'd also been a soldier, was there. And these men were poring over the maps, you know, what was going to happen. But when you're not quite, you know, you're not even 9 years old, you're not quite sure that it's all as dangerous as it obviously was. You know, you don't appreciate that. So.
And did you go to high school in Vancouver?
Yes, I went to McGee. Went to, part of the time I'd start, I was in Point Grey and I was at McGee. And that's where I got it, finished high school before I went to university in 1948.
And what did you study as an undergraduate?
Not much. Well, you see, in those days you could go to law school with 2 years arts. And when I left high school, I had practically all my first year as senior matric subjects, and I went to summer school, so I started from high school in second year. I did 1 year, and all you had to do was have a second class average and walk out there on whatever registration day was in September and sign up for law school. Oh.
No LSAT?
Nope. I probably couldn't have passed it. As I said to somebody, probably couldn't have passed it. I don't know. But there was nothing like that. It was sink or swim. You got into law school, you either swam or you sank. Nobody fussed over you. You know, there were over 100 students in my class. You can go and check those numbers, but I think there were over 100 of us in first year. Some people didn't make it through Christmas, and some people didn't make it through April. But if you didn't make it, the 3 years I was out there, I think I had only one conversation with a professor. I don't know what it cost to go to law school now. It cost $200. Those were the fees.
A year?
Yep. And the only other thing you had to buy were your sort of case books. They were all mimeographed, and you had to work in the library, and if you did well, you did well. If you didn't, well. I mean, there are only something like seven or eight men teaching 300 students. How many are there now at the faculty out there?
60 or more.
And how many students are there?
In the graduate, it's about, they graduate around 180 or 200 in there.
A year?
Yeah.
200 a year?
Less than 200, around 180, 160, I think.
Well, you can see that the ratio of academics to students is much greater now than it was then.
Yeah.
No wonder it costs so much to go there. It was ridiculous, in my view. I thought there's a lot to be said for the sink or swim method.
Did you live at home?
Part of the time. If you call it a home, my first year I lived with my sister and her husband, a little house in Marpole. And second year I boarded with a very nice family out near the university for half of my third year, and then my mother came back from overseas and we moved to the West End. That's where I finished up, living in the West End. But
what was the curriculum in those days?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first year, first of all, it was all very cleverly arranged. All our lectures were in the mornings. So you went to lectures from 8:30 to 11:30. The rest of the day was clear. So you could study to your heart's content. Or as some of the young men who did, who were still veterans, you know, in my class, the part of the class was veterans. I think they had part-time jobs because they had wives and children and so forth. And the basic of the, it was pretty basic stuff first year. Torts, contracts, real property. I don't remember what else there was in the first year. Maybe criminal law and something or other else. 15 hours of lectures. And after that, write the exams at Christmas if you, the first year. If you make it, that's fine. If you don't, well, You'll find out whether you're any good at it. Write the exams in April, and then you'll know, won't you?
And had you had you always wanted to study law? Did you have
time I was about 12.
What do 12-year-olds know about it?
I really don't know. I have absolutely no idea of why.
I know there's many politicians have legal backgrounds, but was it a political?
Don't think so.
Did you have family friends who were lawyers, maybe?
No. I didn't have any family friends who were lawyers at all. I don't know.
Who were some of the professors? You said there were 7 or 8 lecturers.
Well, there was Dr. McIntyre. He taught torts. And he was a wonderful lecturer. And the thing he most emphasized really was that before you can solve any legal problem, you have to ask the right questions. And you do. And he was a very good lecturer. Mr. Reed, who taught contract, he had been a professor at Dalhousie, and I think he was out there. He'd retired, and probably twisted his arm to come back because they were short-handed. All these veterans poured in after the war. He was rather on the dull side. McAllister, who taught real property, he was very good at it. Though I don't know that I could tell you what the rule in Shelley's case is anymore. But I remember early on in that September, he asked two or three the men who sat at the front about something or other. I always sat so far at the back nobody'd even know I was there. And they hadn't done their work that they were supposed to do, and he was so mad he banged his books together and walked out on us. After that everybody did their work.
did you must
I never did ask him any questions, fortunately.
He must have felt humiliated.
Well, I think he was just furious that people didn't realize that if they didn't study ahead of time, they wouldn't get the what they wouldn't learn anything from him. He's wasting his time. You know, but that's the way it was. So, I mean, the dean did some teaching, history of English law. He taught some of it, Dean Curtis. Occasionally we get a lecture from Dr. McKenzie. He'd come around too and talk about his travels.
That's Norman McKenzie, president of the university.
But they all, you know, so that the staff was very small. And as far as I know, they didn't have any teaching assistants or anything, these men. And when April came, I think each of them taught one course in each year. So can you imagine, they each had 300 papers to mark? I mean, they must have worked very hard. And they truly knew their... And the thing I liked about... And looking back on it from... And I think it must be different from the way things are. I never had the feeling that any of them had any agendas that they were trying to promote. They were there to teach us what the law was as it was then, and that's the way it is. Didn't mean that they wouldn't say that the law would never change, but they weren't pushing anything. There was nobody pushing Aboriginal rights or women's rights or any other stuff.
Is that what they call black leather?
Black letter law approach to things? Yes. Yeah. If you don't know anything, what can you do? How can you be a physicist if you don't know any mathematics?
So they were providing the basic curriculum and what
That's
you would
right.
need to...
things you had to know. I remember when the tort, it all began with famous case of IDS in wife and WDS, which is the basis of the law of assault, and was decided, what, about 1200? That's where it began.
What? I don't know that one, because I'm not a lawyer, but...
Well, that was, I guess, you know, it's IDS, that's I, and then small DE, of so-and-so, and wife, and so, and, you know, such, I don't know.
Hmm.
The wife of, wife number two had threatened wife number one with a fist, as I recall it. But of course, it's very fundamentally, it's a fundamental aspect of the law of assault. Not that we have very many assaults anymore, but, you know, that's where they began at the beginning. So, and it surprises me often now how little some young lawyers know of anything, of, you know, where anything came from or how we got here. Well, perhaps it doesn't matter. Oh, even the Chief Justice of Canada, I was talking to her not very long ago, she was complaining about young lawyers who don't seem to know how to know, don't know anything beyond, that goes back to the days before everything was put on the internet or computers or whatever it is. You know, they don't seem to know that there were things decided in the 19th century, the 18th century, and even the early 20th century that they ought to know about. So there you are.
So there was the lecturers had a historical emphasis, did they?
Well, I suppose you could say that. They had an emphasis on what the law is now and how it got there, and you had to know all this stuff.
In all the different aspects of law.
Yes, you had
law.
To know it all.
So you feel you got a good grasp of the...
I did, but you got out of it what you put into it. You know, as I said, sink or swim.
And I should ask before we leave law school, were there other women? Were there many women? We met one, we interviewed one, I think who was in your class, Pat Proudfoot.
Pat Fallman, as she was. Fallman. Yes, she was in my class. And Dolores Branca, Mr. Justice Branca's daughter, later was a judge of the provincial court. And Joan Snape Marshall, who practiced for some years, and then after she had married and had children, she didn't. So there are, I think, seven of us to begin with in my class. And in the year ahead of me, the gold medalist was Connie Holmes, later married. She practices in Victoria. And the runner-up in her year was Shirley Thompson, who married a naval officer and gave it up altogether. So,
but it sounds like we should perhaps talk to some of these other.
Well, you could talk to Mrs. Isherwood, and you'd find her in the phone book in Victoria. Her maiden name was Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S.
Is she a Holmes from Victoria?
Well, she's a Holmes from Victoria, but I'm not sure a Holmes of the Holmes.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean by that, I'm sure you do. I don't know much about, I never did know much about Connie's family, although we were friends. And she grew up in Victoria, and I saw them drop by for a visit about a year ago, and she was still practicing then, although she's older than I am.
And articling, I suppose, came at the end of things. How did you, was that competitive? Was it,
no.
What happened there?
Well, Bullhauser was looking for some students. And David Tupper came out to the university and interviewed a few people, and I think my marks were of sufficiently impressive. I was offered a job. $50 a month.
What sort of interview would it, I mean, how
I
did
can't
that
remember
work?
What kind of interview it was. And for all I know, although I have no idea about this, he may have talked about the applicants or the potentials with his father, R.H. Tupper. And R.H. Tupper had been in the Army in the First World War, and he and Dad had been out at Hastings Park at the same time. Mr. Tupper, of course, was Major Tupper, and Dad was only Lieutenant Southern, but, you know, so it probably helped a bit. But I didn't know that at the time. I was first in my class, and in my graduating year, I was second in the class. That helped a lot, you know, getting a job. Helped a lot.
So you had the...
You
had a lot going for you.
Yeah. I had an interview before that with Mr. Ian Shaw, and Lawrence Shaw and McFarlane, who said to me, "Well, Miss Southern, we've never had a woman law student, and I don't think we're about to start now." Wouldn't that get him in trouble nowadays? Anyway, a few years later, I remember him phoning me up and saying, "That was the biggest mistake we ever made." I thought that was very gracious of him. I didn't hold it against him. But I'd been lucky in the sense that at Bullhauser, the first woman who had ever articled in British Columbia had articled at Bullhauser.
Who was that? Do you know?
I've forgotten her name now. But so they and one of Mr. Bull's daughters had become a lawyer, although she'd married and gone off to Australia. But so they had a history of women being around the place, and Mr. Tupper was Mr. Tupper Sr. was somebody who, I don't think he had any prejudices, you know? Well, his only prejudice was not doing your work right. Ooh, that you got you in big trouble. He was very demanding. But it was there again. How do you learn if nobody demands anything of you? So,
was it a big law firm?
Bullhauser? Well, it was big by the standards of the day. I think there were 15 lawyers that occupied 1.5 floors of the old Royal Bank building at 675 West Hastings. That was a pretty good-sized firm in those days. Mr. Bull, George Hauser, Tupper, Hugo Ray, who became was part of the time I was there as a student, the Reeve of West Vancouver, Geordie Guy, and Colonel Merritt, who was a Tupper on his mother's side, when he'd come back from having won the VC at Dieppe and spent the rest of the war in a German prison camp.
What did you say his name was?
Cess Merritt.
Cess Merritt, of course.
Yeah. He never had any resentment about the Germans either. Curious, isn't it? So
what sort of things did they, what were your duties? Did they move
you
around?
Everything. The law students did everything. They did everything from going up to the land title office or the land registry, searching things, looking up law things. If a partner happened to get his car impounded for illegal parking, going down and getting it out. That's such a thing. I bet nobody has to do it anymore, protesting a bill of exchange. I bet you don't even know what I'm talking about, do you? Well, I don't suppose they even teach about that anymore at law school, but no, so much international trade was done with bills of exchange, letters of credit and that sort of thing. If a bill of exchange wasn't paid at the time and place it was supposed to be paid by whoever issued it, you had to go to wherever you had to go and protest it for non-payment. I don't know when all that stopped, but and I never had to go and arrest a ship. A friend of mine, in her law firm, she was sent down once to arrest a ship, something which you do by fixing the warrant of arrest to the mast.
Was that Patricia Proudfoot?
No, that was Joan Snape Marshall who had to do that because she was a student of T.G. Norris, who did some maritime work. I said, it must have been pretty exciting to do that. Well, there had been some kind of a collision. You know, that's when the ships got to get arrested for... they have to stay put until everything gets worked out. We don't have collisions between ships the way we used to.
Well, I suppose that with a busy port like Vancouver, you would naturally... there would be issues arising from things like collisions.
Well, there used to be quite a lot of... there were, because before radar and that sort of thing, you can imagine out there in the Gulf, it wasn't so much, I think, within the port itself, but at sea. And if you go back and you look in the British Columbia Law Reports going back, say, in the early 20th century, when Archer Martin was the district judge in Admiralty, there were often collisions of one kind and another. It's dark and stormy. And the tugboat captains, like my grandfather, they would often be in a position where they'd be coming down the coast and pulling a big boom of logs, and if it got dangerous enough, the only thing to do was cut the boom loose. If you didn't cut the boom loose, there was the risk that the boom would come over the tug, and things like that, drag the tug down. And so it was not exactly a risk-free existence shipping on this coast. Well, we've had some terrible shipping accidents on here, like the Princess Sophia at near Rupert. Was that 1918?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And various, as they say, collisions of one sort and another. I guess the last collision we have had on this coast of any consequence was in... it has to be a long time ago now, when the Russian freighter ran into the BC Ferry in Active Pass.
Yeah, it was about 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Now the freighters aren't allowed to go through there anymore. Haven't been allowed to go through there. It's just so narrow. So the maritime bar was quite busy at one time. And when we were at law school, we had a choice at our third year. The only choice we had throughout the whole thing was to take either maritime law or municipal law. I took the shipping. It was very interesting. Much more interesting than municipal law, which is as dull as ditch water.
What was that other kind?
Shipping.
But the other one?
Municipal law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why that choice in third year?
Well, it was more interesting. It sounded a little more romantic than municipal law.
I suppose if you had the family background.
Well,
too.
I don't think that was probably it. And I've forgotten who it was that taught municipal law, but John Bird taught shipping, and people said he was quite good at it and quite entertaining, and he certainly was a good lecturer. Because part of the way that they coped with staffing was to use outside lecturers from the downtown bar for subjects that they had nobody on the staff who was really qualified to teach. Leon Ladner taught taxation, income tax. Bird taught shipping. Stan Remnant, who was later a judge of the county court, taught criminal law. And J.O. Wilson taught us procedure. There may have been some other, I can't remember, but I don't think, not for me. And they were all very, it was very good of them to contribute their time that way. Otherwise, the university couldn't have functioned.
With those seven or eight permanent faculty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, they filled the role that sessionals...
I suppose you could say that, yeah.
Assistant, yeah.
They were,
Were they paid?
I have no idea what the arrangement was. None.
But it seems handy to have the town and gown combination. You would get to know some of the downtown lawyers.
I didn't think we got to know them, but
least know
them.
By.
I didn't want to get to know any of them anyway. Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to get to know any of the staff, except to say good morning, sir. And apart from that, I didn't really want to get to know anybody anyway. I wanted to be left alone to study. Yeah.
And they had a, what was the library like? They have a good arrangement.
Well, to begin with, we were in the huts. You know, they're old huts. Everything was old huts, army huts. But they had all the books that you basically needed for undergraduate law students: the Dominion Law reports, the Canada Supreme Court reports, the British Columbia reports, the English reports, the All England reports, the, you know, the Law Society of England reports, and things like that. There are plenty of stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And then during the time I was out there, I was either in my second or third year, we moved into what was then thought was the new law school. And now I hear there's a newer building, what is now the third law school. But it was quite adequate, and we didn't, you know, the huts were, they served their purpose. A lot of the boys lived in Fort Camp, which was old huts too. Other people lived in Acadia Camp, which was army huts too. I mean, you just accepted all that stuff, and we're lucky that the war was over. You were lucky the war was over, and the Depression was over, and the war was over.
It was a boom time, wasn't it, the late... Well, it didn't start right away, but after a few years...
Well, things started to pick up, and everybody came... Well, not everybody came home, of course. Every family or friends had somebody who didn't come home. You know? But you just accepted those things. I mean, the son of my mother's best friend was killed in the war, and... things like that, you just, you know.
And the veterans, did they have some kind of deal from the government that?
Oh yeah, they did. They had a DBA. By the time I got there, most of them had come through, but some of them, of course, had not even finished high school before they were in the services. So when the war was over and they got home, they had a whole pass to pick up. I mean, all kinds of people didn't get a decent education in the Depression, you know, because they couldn't afford it. They didn't get anything. So, and I don't know how much they got paid, but they got an allowance, and I guess it was probably, if they had wives and children, it was more than if they didn't. And I don't know whether the government paid their fees. I'm sure you can find all that out. And depending on how long you've been in, I don't think it even depended on how long you've been in the service. But I don't know that. It was a very good scheme. There had been nothing much like that after the first war. So it enabled these young men do what they wanted to do. Some of them thought they wanted to be lawyers. They didn't make very good lawyers, but, you know, some of them did very well.
And there was some kind of time limit on it, too, I think. You had to...
Yeah, you had to sign up and start before something or other. And I think there was a choice, too, between whether you did the educational route or you got money to start buying a house, getting a house. My brother-in-law, who'd been an officer in the Navy, he had no desire to go back to school, so I remember they took their grant to buy themselves a lot down in Marpole and build a house on it. And so they had choices. But there was something for everybody who had served, I think, as long as he served honorably and didn't get kicked out for bad behavior. I don't know what they did about them.
We talked to Jane Bamfield and Joan Cave Brown Cave.
Oh, yes.
Who would have been a bit after you.
Well, Jane was a bit after me because she took an undergraduate degree.
Peacock.
Yeah. No, Jane. Joan Peacock.
Joan Peacock, yeah.
She was after me. She wasn't a couple of years, but Jane I think she probably graduated in 54, 55. You see, Jane and I went, we were at McGee at the same time. And Joan Peacock wasn't, and she married Bob Cave Brown Cave. Jane went off to become a professor at York, I think.
I know she was in Ottawa. But they said that even in their year, I think it was 55, that there were still veterans.
Well, there may have still
quite
been
a crowd, you know, quite
really?
A gang.
Oh, I'm surprised that there was that many. I thought the thing had pretty well run out of steam by the time I graduated. Mm-hmm. But it
so,
was,
sorry.
No.
Oh, I was just going to ask what year you articled. Do you remember?
52, 53. Mm-hmm. I was called in May of 1953.
And what? How did it work, or how does it work now, Graham? You're articling next year, but what? Is it for a year, or does it get extended?
Well, I don't know what they do now, but in my day, it was 1 year, and there was some. You had to go to some lectures, and then you had to pass an oral examination, which was very easy, and that was that. That was that. And then you hoped somebody would offer you a job.
So if you do, presumably the same criteria applied, if you had worked hard and mm-hmm. made a good impression, you would then try and find a job. How did that work?
Oh, well, I don't know how it worked for most people. I was very fortunate that somebody who had been in my class at law school knew Ike Shulman, who had gone into partnership with Arthur Folks. They were in the East End Bar, and they were looking, their business was doing very nicely, and so they were looking for somebody, and I was introduced, and I was offered a job, and that was that.
This was 1953?
Yep. East End Bar, so the East End, it was a wonderful experience for a young woman brought up in the rather sheltered life of Carisdale, to be working for a firm, many of whose clients were quite, they came of all sorts. Prospectors, crooks, left-wing trade unions, wonderful experience.
Where were their offices?
In the old Standard Bank building. You know where that is? It's at the corner of Richards and Hastings. I don't know, I guess it's still there.
And what was their name again?
Shulman, S-H-U-L-M-A-N, Folks, F-O-U-K-S, and Tupper, T-U-P-P-E-R. Harold Tupper was a distant cousin of the Tupper of Bullhauser, distant cousin. But Arthur Folks was largely in the, I've forgotten, Alberta Meat Company, that's what his family owned, so he spent more time selling meat than he did practicing law. But it was a very interesting experience for somebody who led a rather sheltered life to encounter all these people. Wonderful experience.
You said they were there and had an East End practice, but their office was downtown.
Well, I know, but anybody whose clients were prospectors and crooks of one sort and another and whatnot was sort of generally lumped as the East End Bar because the East End was where all the crooks were.
well, tell that to who did we interview who lives just around the corner here?
Marvin
from
Storo.
Marvin Storo. We'll met.
Well, I don't know.
He's from Commercial Drive.
Yeah. No. But Marvin never practiced law on the east side of town.
No.
No.
So you had a job at 20,
I had a job.
22 years old?
22, yeah.
That's pretty good. That's good.
Well, nothing, you might as well get started young. This business of extending people's education, I don't mean to be rude, but I don't think it's a good idea. The sooner you get through with all this academic stuff and start making a decent living, the better off you are.
The
I think the sooner the better. I mean, I I didn't want to go on spending my life at university. The sooner I could get out of that place, the happier I was.
It reminds me of me a little bit of the fur traders who I used to write about, who left school when they were 15.
Yeah.
And they had to write in a journal every day, so they became literate.
Yeah.
James Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's something in that.
Well, I suspect, I never proved this sort of thing, that there's a kind of an underlying thing. If you extend the educational business for a long enough period of time, you keep the young ones out of the labor force. You're not competing for the jobs. Now, some disciplines, obviously, you cannot do it that way. I mean, you will not make a heart surgeon by the time somebody's 21. That is physically impossible. But you can make a lawyer out of somebody by the time he's 21.
They've changed the degree from LLB to JD. It's now a doctorate you're going to get.
Well, that's rather stupid.
Just the name.
Silly. It's silly. You shouldn't have to have an undergraduate degree to go to law school. In fact, I think there's a danger if you've got too much, if you know too much, that you start not learning the law, but putting too much stuff in it that you shouldn't put into it when you're young. But however, I just think the idea of not being able to make a living as a lawyer until you're nearly 30 is silly. And it's a waste of public money, too. The law is not that demanding a discipline. It's not physics, chemistry, anatomy.
No. What are some of the qualities you need?
Well, you have to be really to work hard. You have to be able to read and write English and understand it. And not, especially to be able to write it. To be lucid. That horrifies me sometimes when I even read the Globe and Mail. This morning, one of the men who write the Globe and Mail he meant to say that so-and-so was circumnavigating the continent. But he talked about him circumventing it. I mean, I see so many mistakes like that and think, if you can't write a clear, decent English sentence, you'll never make a decent lawyer.
Is there a course now, Graham, in sort of legal writing, or do you know?
Yeah, there's a bunch.
So there is a way there's an opportunity to pay attention to writing while at law school.
Well, the best way to pay attention to writing is to read people who write well. No? Remember, you're going to be an old man by my standards by the time you get out.
It's true.
But, of course, 1953, it was a boom time in BC.
Oh, yes, and some of the young people who left law school in those years went off to places like Port Alberni, Prince Rupert, Prince George. A friend of mine went to Pooscoopy. They made a good living too, and they were all the lawyers that there were. These towns had no lawyers. There were lots of opportunity because things were picking up.
It was the Bennett era. There were the resource industries, mining, logging, fishing, farming, transport.
And they weren't impeded on every hand by people complaining that it's going to interfere with the poor wee caribou.
There were no environmentalists.
No, that isn't right. Not quite right. For instance, I'm not sure what year it was. that Bennett got the idea of the building of what is known, was known as the Moran Dam on a canyon up above Lytton on the Fraser. Well, all hell broke loose because all sorts of people who were not ordinarily upset about these things were sure that building that dam would wreck the Fraser for the sockeye forever because it would raise the temperature of the water. So that dam was never built. So to say that nobody cared is simply not accurate. I mean, there were people who cared, for instance, about the building of those dams on the Columbia. But for somewhat different reason. I remember my mother was disturbed by that because one of her first teaching jobs after she graduated from university was up on the Arrow Lakes. And of course, if you've ever seen the Arrow Lakes, it is obvious that they were far more beautiful before those dams were ever built. That the building of the dams brought the water levels down and affected the look. And it also affected, of course, the Americans had already done a pretty good job themselves by dams on the Columbia affecting the salmon on the lower Columbia. I don't think the runs have ever come back on the Columbia in the States. Nor will they, probably. But so it's not so to say that nobody cared about things, because obviously they did. We didn't get Stanley Park because nobody cared. We didn't get Beacon Hill Park because nobody cared. Begbie wrote a judgment about Beacon Hill Park. It's well worth reading. He said, if we don't look after these things, our posterity will never forgive us. There were words to that effect. I've forgotten exactly what the words were, but it's in the BC report. So that people did care, but they weren't. And they did things about some things, but they also knew they had to eat.
And the resources were there.
The
old growth timber was still there.
Fish. And the Fraser River was just full of sockeye. I mean, was it the 1913? Wasn't that the biggest run in history? I think so. Huge sockeye run. Somebody wrote it. You could practically walk across the river on them.
You also had Haig Brown over in in Campbell River, who was an environmentalist and a magistrate.
Because that was much later. Well, that was in the 50s. Because he was pretty prominent about 1950, 51, 52 in there. So you think, well, there were things that, you know, people knew they had to eat. I think it's very interesting, for instance, to go down to Old Strathcona and you realize, you know, people just built their houses any old place. And then they had to change the road levels and whatnot. Have you ever walked around down there?
I haven't.
Well, you should. You should go down there sometime. Just go down Main Street to the block past the railway and bus station there and walk up and keep walking and then wander in and around all those places and the funny little old houses and how they... you could tell what they did. But it didn't mean that they didn't care. That's why they cared out here at Point Grey so much. That's why we've got accursed maple trees on the city streets. Enormous trees that cause an enormous amount of mess, all because the reeve at the time, George Walken, just loved trees. That's why the whole municipality of Point Grey has got boulevards and trees everywhere. Big trees. That's why we've got these terrible, some of these streets around here, we've got chestnut trees. They make the biggest mess. So. But
well,
now, I'm going to worry about some spotted owl.
Well, certainly the last 30, 40 years have been the era of the environmentalism and
Well, it comes and goes.
But you know, we're, I'm just wondering if we've been splitting some interviews in half when we don't quite get through, and I just wonder, because you've got all kinds of, you've had a career as a judge, and we're not up there yet. I wonder if we should start.
Oh, no, no, I think we have to get this over with.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
We have to get it over with, because this house is going to be nothing, the turmoil is getting worse and worse with the work being done in the house, and the Christmas coming, it's either we finish it now, or I don't think so.
Well,
if you've got the energy, I can carry on for another 45 minutes or so.
You're all right?
And if you'd like, if you want, neat or what, there's a washroom around the corner there. If you and get or help yourself to more coffee or whatever you'd like to do.
I'd love some more coffee in a minute.
Or help yourselves.
Should we take a minute break and?
Well, you can go. You fellows could be very helpful. You can get me a cup of coffee. It should still be hot because what time is it? It was made just before you came, and it's supposed to stay hot for 2 hours.
And you're